Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail! This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. For the purposes of this particular podcast, you may call me Ruckmeister McCool.
Please do. And here's how this works. You send us an email. You send us a letter. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And then we read them. We answer them. We answer your questions. We respond to your criticisms. We give recommendations of anything you want, really. The floor is yours. We also have a P.O. box for those who prefer to send ye old paper letter mails.
It's not so ye old. It's just the mail. It's a postal service. It's still offered in this country.
I just like saying it, but it's yes.
I don't even like snail mail. Just send us a letter.
Send us a letter, but you have to write it by candlelight. And Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Using a tallow candle. None of that beeswax nonsense.
None of y'all beeswax, Whitney.
Send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, and this is your show. This is where you get to dictate what we discuss, so let's not dilly-dally. Whitney, let's jump right into our first email.
Here's a letter from James. Hello, James.
Hi, James.
Dear William and Whitney, after listening to your discussion on how to fix the rating system, this is something we did on our last letters episode, I would like to suggest something that I know Americans are none too fond of. James is English. But I trust you to be more open to a look at how other countries do it, to see if us foreigners might have some ideas worth copying. I saw This Film Is Not Yet Rated. That's a documentary film by Kirby Dick, which is excellent. It kind of tries to blow the lid off of the American rating system.
Mm-hmm.
When it first came out, so I have a general idea of the problems of what happens in the USA. I'm English. So here's how the BBFC, the British Board of Film Classification, differs. The modern rating system in the UK is almost identical to that of the USA. U for universal, all ages.
Makes
PG,
sense.
Parental guidance, older supervision recommended for the under 8s. 12A, older supervision required for the under 12s, 15, restricted to 15 plus, and 18, restricted to 18 plus.
Okay, so a couple extra categories in the middle area.
Well, just more different ages, age brackets.
Well, yeah, but we have G, PG, PG-13, I guess it is the same, but if you include NC-17, I guess it's the same number. Yeah, fair enough.
Just like the MPAA, this is all technically voluntary, but no major cinema or shop would sell something that hasn't been rated. However, 18 is commonplace in both. The maximum rating carries no financial penalties, which is unlike here in the United States. There are some retailers who will not stock NC-17 rated films.
Well,
Walmart, most notably, and Blockbuster Video back when they were a thing.
And indeed, there's no rule that says they can't. They've decided not to. My point is that that's not a socially... That's not a political choice. That is a social choice.
Okay.
So technically, they could if they wanted to. Okay. But yeah, fair enough. There is, unfortunately, a economic cost to it. Yeah.
Where the UK differs drastically to the USA is that these ratings are fully explained and transparent. The most bizarre part of the Kirby Dick documentary is the notion that the MPAA doesn't explain its judgment, leaving the filmmakers to guess what they think should be cut to make a rating. No such mystery exists in the UK. In that documentary, there's actually an interview with John Waters, and they rated his last film, and it was the last film he's made to date, A Dirty Shame, which came out in 2004. And it came back with an NC-17. It's like, well, I was actually being very responsible. There's nothing, like it's sexual and there's nudity and there's, a lot of fetish talk in this.
But he wasn't trying to push any buttons. Like, he wasn't, like, he was trying to, like, keep it... For John Waters, it's pretty measured.
It's kind of, could have been a lot less restrained. And he said, okay, well... What is it? Like, is there, like, a certain scene or a shot or something that should be cut? And they just said, there's 1,000 brush strokes. You can't cut 10. It was just pervasive throughout. So they just had to release it with an NC-17. And it wasn't a success as a result of that. Anyway, back to the letter. It says, the movie Daredevil with Ben Affleck got a 15 rating in the UK because of a brief moment towards the end where Jennifer Garner's hand is impaled by a dagger and she is seen in pain.
Yeah.
In order to get a 12A cinema release, they removed those 5 seconds.
Okay, yeah.
While
sense.
A few films in the USA get the lowest rating, plenty of those same films get a U in the UK. Toy Story 2, 3, and 4 all got a universal rating.
Okay.
But the original didn't, and if you want to know why, it's right out in the open on the website. I will save you some time. It's the neighbor Sid, particularly the bit with the fireworks, which has been classified as a dangerous, imitatable behavior.
Yeah, that tracks. Mm. It's a listen, whether or not you agree with it, that's a understandable reason. I can get that. Yeah. You understand little kids might want to do that. Yeah.
In my reading of your discussion, Whitney immediately took the stance of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. There's no consideration that not just parents, but film watchers in general use ratings as guidance. I'm the same age as you, but if the film is rated 18, I'll check for more information because there are certain things like torture porn that I have no interest in watching. Ratings have uses. No one in the UK has the conversation about replacing U and PG with a single rating because there is a clear documented difference. If there's no practical difference between G and PG, then why jump to immediately to getting rid of one without considering if it could be fixed instead? The transparency of each band builds trust with parents. My friends with young children know any U film is fine to leave a child with, while PG means keeping an eye out in case their child gets disturbed. And this transparency prevents the different treatment of hetero and homosexual relationships, because any such hypocrisy can be brought forth publicly. The 1999 film American Pie and But I'm a Cheerleader both got 15 ratings in the UK, both for sexual references, irrespective of gender and sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie Babbitt, who directed But I'm a Cheerleader, is also the film is not yet rated.
Yeah.
Because But I'm a Cheerleader was initially going to get an NC-17 rating. Because there is, it's queer, mm-hmm. which, you know, that's a big issue.
Yeah, the MPAA tends to rate anything queer much more harshly than anything.
If two women kiss, boom, it's already an R rating. It doesn't matter how innocent the material is.
Yeah.
And there was also a scene in the movie that they actually ended up having to cut where the Natasha Lyonne character is masturbating.
Yeah.
Not nude, just like over her clothes.
Even. Yeah.
And... Jamie Babbitt was incensed because her film was going to get an NC-17 rating for that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Jason Biggs had sex with a pie in American Pie around the same time. And that was never threatened with an NC-17.
That was never threatened? That movie is...
It's incredibly crass.
It's incredibly crass. You would think it would have at least brushed up the edge of NC-17. Wow.
Yeah,
that's ridiculous.
So if you're considering the UK rating system rather than the US one, do you see a problem? Because it's only the slightest bit different to use to the one in America, yet I don't see any of the issues you identified. However, to present a fair assessment, it should be acknowledged that in the UK, the ratings are a form of censorship. For many decades, the movie Child's Play was not permitted for release in the UK, and I think even now the version available has cuts. There are certain things not permitted even in an 18 movie. Perhaps this will offend some people's sense of freedom, because it is the government saying that there are certain things that even an adult can't access, but those are defined by an act of parliament, not the BBFC.
Right.
As I wrap up, I want to remind you of another country and their interesting approach to ratings. France granted 50 Shades of Grey a 12, meaning any teenager could see it, also meaning none would be interested in doing so. Best wishes, James.
Oh, that's an interesting bit of reverse psychology there. A couple of things you brought up there. First off, other countries do have different rating systems, and they seem to work reasonably well. There's a lot of things that you described about the British rating system that make a lot of sense, having those extra categories between, like, PG and R works for me.
More explicit description as to why it got that rating would be helpful.
Also very, very useful. The fact that there are things that the government still says cannot be in a movie bothers me.
Mm. Keep in mind, England is the source of the term video nasties.
That's true. There's a whole series of films in the, I think, late 70s and 80s when movies started coming out on home video. 71
or 72 of them, yeah.
Yeah, particularly, mostly horror movies, particularly violent films, were labeled as video nasties, and they were not permitted in the UK. You can only get them in, like, the bootleg market.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's actually a pretty good movie that came out last year, I think, called Censor, which is about one of the UK censors who watched ultraviolent horror movies and
to see if they were video nasties,
and they think they see something in a movie that leads them down a rabbit hole, and it's really creepy and it's pretty good.
I was going to review all of the video nasties
for a trip.
This was years ago. This was back in Nerdist,
and
they shit canned me when I got two films in.
You're
writing about horror too much. Well, yeah,
it's what we're doing.
Nerdist, horror nerds are a thing, right?
Anyway. I don't agree with that part of the practice, but I do agree that there's a lot of things that work. I think the reason why, and Whitney, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, if you have a different take on it.
Mm.
I think the reason why when we talk in America about overhauling the rating system, we tend to talk in really big terms, like jettisoning it completely or doing these dramatic changes to it. And that's because Americans don't always handle nuance very well. Like, subtle changes don't necessarily feel big enough. And so if you just added, just changing X to NC-17 was not a dramatic enough change for anyone to even consider that a meaningful difference. Whereas if you dramatically change the whole thing, people are going to notice and it's going to feel like change. And so I think I immediately sort of locked into that idea that in order to get people to go along with this and feel like it's a meaningful change, it needs to be a top-down, dramatic overhaul.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, well, but maybe also, that's me being cynical about Americans. And but well, I've also, seen it. You know,
America. You know, you're writing in and you're talking about sort of the British public's reaction to these these ratings. We have you know, psychopathic Puritans here in the United States. It's the culture is quite different, and there's a lot of there's uptight people everywhere. This is not a uniquely American phenomenon. Well,
there are people who are trying to outlaw selling books about queer people and queer experiences in bookstores.
Outlaw it. So, like, make it against the law. So there's been this weird Puritan push and pull in this country over what can and cannot be permitted in films. So it kind of makes sense that we've eventually settled on, oh, all of the big ones are PG-13 now. That's just a code for a four-quadrant movie that most anybody could watch.
Like,
it's
get
a little
it.
Violent for kids, and everything else is kind of useless.
Yeah. There's a really good... James Gray was interviewed at Cannes recently. You can find it on Twitter really easily. He was interviewed and he was asked about what it's like right now in the film industry, and that it feels like the box office has been so dominated by a certain kind or kinds of cinema, sort of IP-driven blockbusters. And a lot of people just say, oh, it's bad, or I'm so sick of it, or whatever. And he had a good point, which is that it makes sense from an executive perspective.
That you fund the films that are popular.
You fund the films that make money. Okay, so superhero movies make money. Jurassic Park movies make money. These kind of franchise-driven movies make money. We're going to put all of our money into that, and we're going to flood the multiplex with it, and it's great. And he basically had a great speech about how that creates... You know, it works in a way, because you're making that money, but you're actually strangling the audience and not letting them, like, get enough oxygen to, like... experience other films. You know, there are people who will see those movies, but the people who will actually also see The Godfather don't have that option anymore. And you're just creating this kind of weird monoculture, and that eventually hurts you, and it even hurts your bottom line because you can't make a profit doing anything else.
Yeah. Well,
so you can't make, well, my point is this, there's less room for it.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
It's unfortunate.
And I think that goes for ratings as well. There's less room for R ratings to find an audience. There's room for G ratings to find an audience. You know, there's just this sort of thing where it's like, it's all one thing, and you need to be able to find different stuff. Otherwise, it's not going to be able to grow and evolve very well, financially or artistically.
Which is, and I see his point, but it also goes to a type of thinking that I've always tried to discourage, and that is trying to look at the film from the executive's perspective. I don't give a damn what the executive decisions made. If I'm seeing a film and there's a bad decision in there, all I see is that somebody made a bad decision. I'm not interested in hearing your excuses from an executive's perspective.
I guess I'm...
I don't care about how much money they're making. I'm the one consuming. I'm giving you money to see it.
I agree with
so
that.
So I don't need to look at film as a business venture if I got a bad product.
Agree with that, but I think if you want the industry to change, you sometimes need to couch it in terms that the industry can understand.
I suppose so, or what we do is just not see the movie.
Well, I realize that, but there is a way, and I think what James here was talking about is there's a way to do both, which is to enjoy these films, many of which are quite enjoyable, while also allowing other types of films to proliferate.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not as much. That's just the way the industry works. Things go in and out of favor. But we're not letting them proliferate. We're not giving them the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, well,
and
again,
the significant amount of people who want to see different kinds of movies don't have the option to at a multiplex anymore because of this.
And in a way, though, that's kind of on us.
Yeah.
Because we're not going to see a lot of these other movies.
True.
It's also on.
But after a while, we don't have as many opportunities to.
Yeah, so you know? We just stop seeing movies after a while.
Yeah, bummer. Anyway, we got off on a tangent there, but thank you for the perspective.
Yeah,
and, because we're looking at it from a distinctly American perspective, and indeed there are other. If anyone else is from another country or from another culture where ratings are handled in a dramatically different fashion than we've already talked about, we'd love to hear about that. Mm-hmm. That might be interesting. Additional contrast and comparison. Yeah.
Here's another letter on ratings.
Okay.
It's from J-Lo. Thank you for writing in, J-Lo.
Hey, J-Lo.
It says, greeting, folks. Two quick stories about MPAA ratings. First, I recently got to see Frank Henenlotter's Basket Case.
Ooh.
Oh, with a live introduction and afterward Q&A with the director.
Nice.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Very jealous, yeah.
Great fun. Really glad I got to go. Central Pennsylvania usually doesn't get cool stuff like that.
Mm.
One of the stories Henenlotter shared afterwards was on the rating of the movie. The producer said to make an R-rated cut, they submitted that to the MPAA, got the ratings out in the press, and that only then screened the unrated cut, which was the one you should be familiar with. Really cheeky, but I like that a lot. Yeah. Okay, so they submitted a cut, they got an R rating, and then they sent a different cut to theaters.
Yeah.
Just do that.
Yeah. That is not the only time I've heard about that happening, by the way. They don't really follow it.
Yeah, they're not paying attention.
No, what are they going to do? Check every single film? Like, they're not going to, so.
Personally, the only R-rated movie I tried to get tickets to, things were more strict in the 2000s, was District 9.
Oh.
My best friend, my oldest friend, and I wanted to see it at the age of 15. We sent my 17-year-old sister to get tickets, and instead she came back with tickets to The Time Traveler's Wife.
Ooh.
I didn't get around to seeing District 9 until I was 24. Solid movie, should rewatch it at some point. Anyway, keep on keeping on, J-Lo.
I kind of want to know what you thought of The Time Traveler's Wife. I keep hearing things about the show, and it's like, that's not stuff I heard about from the movie.
Mm.
Sounds really weird. But yeah, fair enough. Thank you for writing it.
Right. Here's a letter from Cody. Hello, Cody.
Hey, Cody.
Dear Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool, a few months ago, our dear Rockmeister, hey, that's me,
hey,
responded to a tweet that asked what one would do if they became the chief executive of the Walt Disney Company. In true Whitney fashion, he said we'd release every IP into the public domain.
I love you for it.
I enjoy Whitney's brand of chaos. Yeah, burn it all down. Burn it all down. Every bit of it.
I admire your principles. I do. It's absolute commitment to principles, whether or not they're even right.
Oh, who cares?
Well, it's a complicated issue, but it's fine.
Now say these brands / assets actually were released into the public domain. What property do you make into something, and what do you do with it? My favorite ideas I've come up with so far is Kaiju Goofy. Sincerely yours, Cody.
That's pretty damn funny.
Oh, yuck!
So a lot of people will do these Twitter prompts. So it's like, okay, you wake up one morning and you're Batman. What do you do? At which point, the first thing it is, well, my parents died, so I guess I'll be sad for a while. So let's start with that.
A little bit more practical. If I'm Batman, I turn myself in.
Yeah. Ooh, nice. Whitney, bless him, always comes up with an interesting choice there. But I remember this. Someone said, okay, you wake up, you're in control of Disney, you can do whatever you want with the Disney Corporation. That's not actually how it works. You do have to answer to a board of directors. But anyway, in this fantasy, why ruin fantasy with fact, I'd say? You can do anything you want with Disney. And Whitney's decision was to release all the intellectual property they have into the public domain. My one caveat with that is that some of those intellectual properties were made by people who are still alive and kind of deserve credit and money for their work.
Okay, so here's what we're facing. A company that's earning money from those creators' creations.
Yes.
And aren't giving those creators any money.
I will give them money. First thing I do is I give them the money that they deserve before I even think about releasing it to public domain. I want to make sure everyone got paid.
That's actually a better, if somebody still wants the property back, I'd give it back to them.
Like, for example, if you created the Winter Soldier, the guy who created the Winter Soldier as a character, not Bucky, but that version of the character, famously didn't get paid a lot for that movie. He got paid more for his cameo in the movie than he did for the story that turned into a billion-dollar film.
Give him $50 million.
Well, give him whatever he deserves and give him the character, if you will. And the co-creators, because I know there was an artist as well. But, they get their characters. Anyone who is actually belongs in the public domain, for example, Mickey Mouse, that's public domain.
Okay.
That would be what I would do. I wouldn't just... You decided to go pure chaos. Which,
sure, yes.
Which has both good and bad connotations, I feel.
I know. I'd love to see it, though.
I know, right?
It's like, Star Wars is in the public domain. Go.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That would be great. Would it honestly
just be great? Like any rinky-dink independent filmmaker can I make a Darth Vader movie.
And I'd feel kind of better about that in terms for Star Wars because it was George Lucas's baby. He gave it up.
Yeah.
He gave it up for money, but then he gave that money to charity, bless him.
Mm.
So he doesn't care.
George Lucas said something you never hear anymore from rich people. I have enough money.
Yeah.
He actually said that.
Yeah.
So bless George Lucas for that.
A lot of respect for George Lucas. I'm not going to lie.
I'm rich enough. Like, I made a lot of money off of Star Wars.
And he washed his hands of Star Wars, and he's like, you know what? I'm done. I'm good.
In an interview, he's like, why should I keep making things with Star Wars? Because every time I do, they just tell me I'm a horrible person.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do this anymore. It's gone.
Yeah, fine. I feel bad about that part. But yeah, fair enough.
I don't
like those movies, but like, I get wanting to quit. I get it. Yeah.
I wrote an article today about the actor Jake Lloyd.
Oh, yeah.
He was the child actor from The Phantom Menace.
He was bullied.
He was bullied, and he's just looking into that poor man's life.
Yeah.
Like he moved back home. He's been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia.
Poor guy.
His mom called the cops on him once because he was off his meds.
That's too bad.
He was chased off the road by cops in South Carolina once and ran his car into a tree. He spent 10 months in a jail in South Carolina.
Wow.
I don't know why they had to keep him there that long.
That's sucks. Send
him to a mental institution.
Oh, that's I had no idea about all that.
Yeah, Jake Lloyd has had a pretty miserable post Star Wars life. Like, there's a lot of struggles.
That's true, and that's totally fair. And like, yeah, but I guess, now I'm just bummed out.
Yeah,
but
let's take away Disney's
ability. Let's give it to Jake Lloyd.
There you go.
Let's give Star Wars to Jake Lloyd.
Jake Lloyd doesn't want anything to do with fucking Star Wars.
Okay, we'll give it to Ahmed Best.
There you go.
You're in charge now.
Ahmed Best would be happy.
There you go. I feel like that feels like the story of, like, I remember in the 90s, there were a couple of movies that was, like, where a kid gets a baseball team, like, Little Big League. Like, his granddad owns, like, the Minnesota Twins or something, and he gives it to his grandson. And the kid, he's, like, a little kid. He's, like, 12.
I never saw it, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I probably were getting the team wrong or whatever. But, like, I want to do that. Like, I want to do, like, let's bring back that kind of, like, blank check era at Disney.
Uh-huh.
Where, like, kids rule! But instead of a kid getting a blank check for $1 million, like, the kid, due to, like, a weird loophole at Disney, gets Star Wars. Like an 11-year-old kid gets Star Wars. That is a good idea.
Just some random 11-year-old
kid.
That's
the whole movie. Some random 11-year-old kid through a legal loophole or some weird clause that George Lucas put in his contract that Disney didn't see because it was written in invisible ink or something. All right. All of a sudden, it's like Disney's just like, yeah, it turns out we have to give the whole Star Wars franchise to whichever person buys the 100th ticket to the 10th movie we make. Oh, shit.
Wait a minute, what?
That's why we stopped making movies. We're only doing TV now.
What's the 11-year-old going to do? It's like, first movie, the Wookiees all get along.
Yeah, right? I want that. I want pure chaos.
Here's what I want. They give it to an 11-year-old, but it's a very gentle 11-year-old.
Yeah,
he doesn't
want
any fighting scenes in Star Wars.
You probably want to do something like development or like that. So, like, the initial idea is to do something really, really cool. But then, like, the kid listens to their friends or whatever, and there's like a Star Wars for everybody now, and like,
or the lesson is the kid has this really wonderful idea. It's like I've figured out what I want Star Wars to be, and it's really gentle. It's gonna be like Yoda goes on a walk.
Star peace.
It's like the wars are finally over. It's Star peace, and that's my movie, Star Peace. And he sends it like to all of like the script doctors, and they're the ones who like kind of turn it back into just regular Star Wars again, and he gets really upset.
Yeah,
it's kind of disillusioned.
Or she or they.
Pardon?
Or she or they. It doesn't have to be a boy.
You said 11-year-old boy. But yeah.
I was going off of the blank check mentality, but it doesn't have to be. Yeah. Yeah. That's a fun idea, actually. Shit. If anyone makes that, we should get so much money. But it's Disney, so we won't.
No.
Fair enough. Anyway, we should move on.
Let's pitch it to Disney and get no money or credit.
Thanks, Disney.
But we can tell the story when we have a beer in our 60s. Hey, you know that shitty blank check movie with Star Wars? That was me. Was it? It was you? You, beer man? Yeah, I don't even drink beer. Okay. I actually don't drink beer. I'm a liquor man.
You didn't used to drink anything.
No.
Not even water.
No, I drank water. No, oh, okay. No, I was a teetotaler until like maybe my mid-30s.
Yeah, then he just threw caution to the wind. Fuck it.
It's like I figured I'm in my mid-30s. I'm an adult now. Yeah. I should be able to handle it now.
Well, yeah.
Because I hated booze for a long time.
It wasn't a moral principle. It just wasn't what you're into.
No.
It wasn't like you like thought it was evil or anything.
No, I just didn't want to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
So I didn't.
Yeah, that's how I feel about eating vegetables. Moving on.
Here's a letter from Dr. Nova. Hello, Dr. Nova.
Hey, Dr. Nova.
Hi, Bibbs and Rockmeister. I recently realized I am asexual.
Good for you.
Mazel tov. And I also realized just how weird and sexual my D&D adventures are. Oh, all D&D adventures go there at some point, don't they? It's been very interesting learning that it has come to my notice that the ace representation is somewhat lacking. Mm. The only characters that are asexual is Data, who is a robot who doesn't have emotions, the Doctor from Doctor Who, and Sherlock Holmes, who is straight, straight people keep trying to ship with Irene Adler because she was in a book once.
I mean, she was his match, in terms of, like, intellect and everything. Yeah. I think he was fascinated by her, but yeah, I don't think they were romantic. Mm. I don't think that ever would have worked. Yeah.
Given my annoyance with lack of representation, why do you think this is, given how many Marvel movies aren't sexual at all? Mm-hmm. Do you have any ideas on what characters are ace in any media? Thanks, Dr. Mm-hmm. Nova.
That's a great question.
It is a good question. A lot of, we were just talking about sort of the four quadrant thing, and mm-hmm. A lot of the way the ratings work is sex is given a harsher rating in the United States than violence. Violence is permitted younger audiences, whereas sex is verboten. And, as such, a lot of characters in these big, broad entertainments don't have romantic or sexual attachments at all. They're too busy swept up in the action.
Yeah.
So it is easy to picture them as asexual characters.
That's true. And I think sometimes they might be considered romantic asexual characters and that they have interest in other people, but we don't see any real sexual drive involved. There are very few characters in popular culture who openly identify as asexual. The one I can think of is BoJack Horseman's roommate.
Has said they're asexual.
There's a whole subplot about it in BoJack Horseman. I didn't watch it all, but forget what his name is, actually. It's the one played by the guy from, played by Aaron Paul.
It's not Mr. Peanut Butter, is it?
No. It's the one played by Aaron Paul, like the roommate guy, the human.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
I forget his name. I liked BoJack, but I didn't watch all of it. That character is explicitly ace, and there are subplots about their sexuality and finding companionship.
The issue with the kind of I'm getting really tired of unspoken representation.
Yeah.
This idea where we can kind of drop a hint or have a creator or an actor say something after the film was made saying, oh, no, they're actually of a different sexuality than you thought.
Yeah, but then
if it's not in the movie, then it doesn't really count, does it?
Yeah, if you can watch that movie. Mm. And if you refuse to believe that character could be gay, bi, ace, trans, whatever the storytellers decided they wanted to be subtextual, you're not really doing much good. That's not representation. But I do believe that there are sometimes situations where characters may sort of. I don't know how conscious it is. Like one example someone brought up this year, and I thought was really interesting. The Batman.
Okay.
Matt Reeves' version of The Batman is... People have said that they're on the spectrum, which tracks. It makes sense based on the text. But I've also heard people interpret that character as asexual. A romantic asexual. They're certainly interested in Catwoman as a companion. Mm. But there's nothing sensual about their relationship. Mm. There's nothing... She's bringing more than he is to that. And so that one I'm thinking of like, yeah, I buy that. Yeah, that one works. But again, it's not explicitly stated, which sucks. Mm.
Again, this is because it's a children's cartoon, there wasn't any like explicit sexuality, but Stephen Hillenburg, the creator of SpongeBob SquarePants, has said in an interview that SpongeBob is expressly asexual character.
Yeah, I buy that.
Because, you know, there's like some speculation, are SpongeBob and Patrick actually lovers?
Yeah.
And Steven Hillenburg said, no, well, first of all, he's a sea sponge. Sea sponges are asexual critters.
True.
So he is asexual. And well, what about like Sandy the squirrel.
Yeah.
It's like, is that a love interest? Not really. He doesn't really have romantic interests. He is asexual.
Yeah.
He has best friends. He's a very warm, loving friend character. But Steven Hillenburg has said that SpongeBob is asexual. But because this is a children's cartoon, there's not going to be a lot of sex in it.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how much that counts, because that's, again, extra.
Well, and again, and again, we're going off of subliminal sort of super narrative. But I have been, for a project I'm doing, I have been watching every single Elvis Presley movie. And he made 31 narrative feature films and 2 concert movies in his career. And that, by the way, that's a film career that lasts about 15 years. Like, he was immensely prolific throughout the 1960s in particular. And one of the things that I'm really surprised by is that, you know, his films quickly found a formula. A lot of them are just sort of travel logs. Elvis goes to Acapulco and, you know, balances 2 different women and sings a couple of songs or whatever. That's kind of it. But his persona shifts quite a bit from film to film. And there are multiple films in which he's a little girl crazy, right? Uh-huh. He's like, ooh, got a girl over here and a girl over here, and I'll kiss you and I'll kiss you, and doesn't matter that we're cousins. There's a whole movie called Kissin' Cousins where he's in a love triangle with his 2 cousins, one of whom is played by Yvonne Craig from Batman.
Oh, nice.
It's Yvonne Craig, right?
Yes.
Okay, I thought it was something else.
No, Yvonne Craig.
Okay. Yeah, that's a weird fucking movie. He sings 2 songs about wanting to be with his cousins. It's really weird. However, there are multiple Elvis movies I have found in which the whole gag is that women are constantly trying to get his attention and he is absolutely oblivious and almost completely disinterested except in like a pure companionship level. There's a movie called Follow That Dream where it's basically, imagine if Elvis Presley played Steve Martin's character from The Jerk. Like, that is how completely unaware of everything going on around him that he is. He accidentally robs a bank. He accidentally stops the mafia. And people are constantly trying to have sex with him, and he has no idea what they're talking about. And it's legitimately funny, but I'm reading it as he's ace in several of these movies. I think sometimes the attempt to... They attempted to portray Elvis as a sexual dynamo, which, you know, makes sense for his image. But I think also sometimes in order to make him feel non-threatening, they pulled way back and played him off as almost completely asexual.
Okay.
Which is an interesting thing, and I really didn't see that coming. And it's not in every Elvis movie, but there's at least 2 or 3 so far that I've noticed. It's like that, and like Kid Galahad, where there's a little romance, but it's barely a romance. Like, it barely counts.
Yeah.
And it just, yeah, he's completely disinterested in conventional romance.
Asexuality was a lot. If you look back at sort of like old Hollywood history, there were actually a lot of openly asexual characters. They didn't use the word asexual.
Yeah.
As a way of like skirting censors. And there's a lot of movies about sort of like stuffy old professor characters who just don't have interest in romance or sex at all.
Yeah.
And so those are expressly stated. Oh, I have no interest in sex or women.
Confirmed bachelors. Yeah,
confirmed bachelors. Confirmed bachelor was also code for queer for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But
it could go either way.
It could also be asexual. This is also true of the professor on Gilligan's Island.
He's completely oblivious to Marianne.
Like Ginger would always flirt
with
him.
Ginger
always flirted with him. He's like, I have no interest in women or sex.
Yeah.
So, like, he didn't say the word asexual. It wasn't really common parlance yet. But
he had no interest.
But that...
He explicitly said he had no interest.
He's an asexual character.
Yeah.
You'll note that a lot of the asexual characters are from the old era are intellects.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that they're all in their mind and not in their body at all. So that's a little bit of a cliche that we're dealing with.
I feel like that's some kind of weird external rationale. Like, well, there's a reason. You know, they're just, they're too busy. You know, like that
or
was,
just that they're so wrapped up in the abstract and ideas that they never cultivated their physicality.
Asexuality
kind of
as an identity is
pretty recent.
In terms of being codified, in terms of being it's relatively recent, and it's just something that I think they didn't have the terminology for. For a while there, and so I think there are multiple characters who definitely fit that mold, and I don't think it's necessarily a matter of them trying not to say it outright because of homophobia, in its many forms, queerphobia, and it might also just be a simple fact of the matter of they didn't know what to call that, so that might be a situation as well. If anyone has, especially if it's overt. If anyone can think of other characters who are explicitly stated in film, television, major popular culture to be asexual or gray sexual, please let us know, because it is dramatically underrepresented. And there's a lot of people who just don't see that representation at all because they're not watching those three things.
And like I've said, it's also a matter of going beyond like a popular perception of the character and going with like a textual example.
Yeah. Exactly. It needs to be. I mean, if I'm interested, if you have any interpretations of noteworthy characters who are not explicitly stated to be asexual, if you believe that they are for you've observed good criteria. Fine, that'd be awesome, but I'm especially interested if anyone else knows of any characters who are explicitly stated to be asexual or gray sexual.
Yeah.
Please let us know.
And in a positive way, because there's actually a lot of negative examples of asexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, you'll notice that I was talking about sort of the intellects. Those are usually male characters.
Typically, yeah.
The asexual male characters are like intellects and bookworms.
Yeah.
The asexual female characters are like prison wardens. And you know, like Mrs. Yeah. Togar from Rock and Roll High School. That's like villainess kind of characters.
Or the plot of the movie is they just don't know what romance is.
Yeah, they just need to be charmed. Yeah.
Like you could look at someone, you could even look at, say, a character like from like She's All That. Where the main character, Rachel Lee Cook.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to remember if they actually explicitly said that she has any interest in romance and it's just stymied because she's in high school. You could take a character like that, and the whole point is to bring them out of their shell.
Yeah.
What if that's not a shell?
Yeah.
Well, if that's just an identity and we're not really talking about it well.
And, you know, that is a thing. People who are, you know, shy and need to sort of like build up confidence and gain courage.
But that's not everybody.
Those are things that are certainly good messages to have in a movie. I think it's fine, but.
I always resented the idea that every introvert is an extrovert waiting to be given permission to at a party whenever they drink booze. That's not fair. Come on.
It's the booze element I always resented. Yeah. It's like, oh no, all anybody needs to do is drink. Yeah. Oh, that's healthy.
Yeah.
Like, oh no, I'm having family troubles. Yeah, but if we get together and smoke weed, everything will be okay. Really?
Yeah.
Because you just get high, and then you're not high anymore, and you still have the same family troubles. Nothing's been solved, you know.
Anyway, yeah.
I looked up a quick list. Here's one I didn't... There's a lot of characters from, like, anime that I don't know about, so I can't really speak to those. But somebody pointed out on one of these lists, Henry Higgins. From George Bernard Shaw's original version of Pygmalion.
Very much, a little less so My Fair Lady, but Pygmalion, definitely, yeah.
Yeah. In the movie, they made it a little bit more romantic. But notice that the big romantic song in My Fair Lady is not I'm in love.
I've grown accustomed
to her face.
Yeah.
Isn't that an asexual way of going about it?
That's a great... And if you go back to the original, like, 1937, 1938 movie, I think it's much more there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's, yeah, actually, good call.
Henry Higgins, good asexual.
Very good call, yeah.
Again, that's another intellect, though. It's another sort of bookworm.
Well, yeah, agreed, and that is a stereotype, but still, yeah, tracks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway. We got time for more letter.
One or two. Sorry, I got a little carried
away. No, it's fine. It's an interesting topic, and it doesn't get discussed enough, so thank you for bringing it up.
Yeah.
Here's
a letter from Tom Kenny. Speaking of SpongeBob, I'm guessing it's a different Tom Kenny.
Probably a different Tom Kenny.
Well, if you are the real Tom Kenny, not the real Tom Kenny, if you're the Tom Kenny we're thinking about, I love you on the edge.
Yes.
The sketch comedy show from 1993.
Yes, Whitney is the one.
I'm the one fan. Me and Julie Brown were the only ones who liked that show. Anyway, Thomas Kenny says, hello. You have mentioned Fabio more in the last year than anyone has mentioned Fabio in the last 30 years combined.
Yay!
I have nothing else. I just wanted to say I love it. Thank you, Thomas Kenny.
Because we love Fabio.
Because every woman wants to be... Not everyone wants to be Fabio.
We're making fun of a little bit... Okay, so in case you're new to this, romance novels are a billion-dollar industry. And in the 80s and 90s, a lot, like a staggering number of romance novels, had this one cover model on them. His name is Fabio. He goes by just Fabio, although he has a full name.
That's his real first name, by the way.
Yeah. He shortened it. Just goes by Fabio.
It's like Luca Brazzi or something.
Sure. He's very muscly.
Lanzoni is his name. Okay, Fabio Lanzoni.
He's very muscly. He's got like a really... He looks like if Mr. Incredible was a person, but if Mr. Incredible had like... hair from like the lead singer of Whitesnake. Like it's really long flowing blonde
hair. Very luxurious hair, gigantic man, like just as wide as he was tall.
Pecs like melons. He looks like a comic book character. Like it's really he's a stereotypical image of a certain form of beautiful masculinity. And he was on covers for countless romance novels. And he became quite famous doing it, and he would end up doing things like do TV appearances, and he was in a commercial for I Can't Believe It's Not Butter for some reason. And
that was his... He earned a lot of money from that.
I'm sure he did.
You know what his first movie was? I bet you know.
Ooh. Oh. Exorcist 3?
Yeah, it was. It was Exorcist 3.
Oh my god, why do I know that?
You just want to slow down.
Oh my god. He was enormously famous for a while. They're a little bit more obscure now. And there was the moment that I will always associate with Fabio isn't actually directly Fabio related. Well, he wasn't in it anyway. But in Mystery Science Theater 3000, Joel was the host for about 4 or 5 seasons. And every episode would begin with an invention exchange. And Joel was kind of a gadget comedian. He would invent a lot of things. Not like, say, Carrot Top, for example.
He was a prop comic.
He was a prop comic. That was his shtick, yeah. He would invent fun gadgets, and that was his shtick. And when he left the show, they quickly realized that the invention exchange was a Joel thing. It didn't really... It's hard to keep up with that pace if you're not Joel Hodgson.
But they tried for a while,
for about half a season, they
Mike's
tried.
Thing, yeah.
But for a half a season, one of those invention exchanges was Fabio. It was a kit that allowed you to become Fabio. It came with a blonde wig, a big large chin, and pecs. And you would just be Fabio. We are Fabio. Yeah. Men want to be Fabio. Women want Fabio. Are you Fabio? You could be Fabio. Yeah. So just saying Fabio is
Star of book covers, magazines, and our tours of our own line of chest grease.
I remember Fabio through that, I think, more than anything else.
He quickly became a joke because he's just
larger than life kind of character,
such a caricature kind of character. So he'd show up in like certain things as as himself, just playing like big hunky man
spoof movies. Yeah, I think he did one with he was in something with Leslie Nielsen.
He was in Spy Hard.
That was in Spy Hard. Yeah,
and eventually he started showing up in like even broader, like he showed up on one of the Sharknado sequels.
Sure. That's about right.
Like that was the level of fame where he was at. And I think he kind of resented that for a while.
Sure he did.
Also, he was cursed by God.
What?
There was a really horrendous incident involving Fabio that was in the news like back in the mid 90s. And you probably remember this, where he was the celebrity get for the opening of a new roller coaster.
Fabio
was like, okay, we're gonna have the first run of this roller coaster with the public. People are gonna get on, you're gonna ride, it's gonna be a lot of fun. You're Fabio, we're gonna get a lot of pictures with you.
Yeah.
He got on the roller coaster and it was really, really tall.
Yeah, this is very common to get like a celebrity to open a roller coaster local newspapers, photo
exactly,
ops.
And Fabio, that's as big a celebrity as they could get, was Fabio.
Not bad.
He got on the roller coaster, they went up to the top. And a bird, a seagull, a really big bird, flew right into his face.
God.
and broke his nose.
Oh my god.
The bird died.
Oh.
And he got off the roller coaster at the end of the first ride and there's blood streaming down his face and he's crying.
Poor Fabio.
It's horrible because he got really badly injured.
Well, yeah, that would do it. That sucks.
First of all, it's like, when does that ever happen to anybody? Secondly, it's Fabio.
Poor guy. I never felt bad for Fabio before, but like, now I kind of do. It sucks.
Oh no, it's a terrible situation. Larry Bud Melman was struck by lightning. It's like this really weird. Confluence of events.
Anyway, well, now that we've really humanized Fabio, which I think is really, really good. But yeah, we talk about Fabio sometimes, and we also found a book that Fabio wrote about Fabio going back in time. And I still need to read it, actually. It's on its shelf right here. I can see it. Yeah. But anyway, thank you for writing it about Fabio.
Fabio is also still single.
Oh.
He said I think there was something in his contract, actually, that he wasn't allowed to date or marry.
Oh, that's fucked up.
Yeah, because, like,
He needs to be considered available.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So maybe he did date somebody secretly, but he wasn't allowed to have, like, public relationships.
Is it like that, it's almost like that Sarah Michelle Gellar McDonald's thing?
Oh, was she not allowed to date?
No. She wasn't allowed to go to McDonald's.
Oh, was there, like, something in her contract? Well, she wasn't allowed to eat McDonald's?
Hold on, let me make sure I'm getting this right, because if memory serves, when Sarah Michelle Gellar was a child actor...
Okay.
She did a Burger King commercial.
Oh, okay.
Where she said something to the effect of, I never eat McDonald's.
Oh, like, as a child.
It was the first commercial to ever mention a competitor by name.
Oh, no kidding, all right.
Yeah. And indeed, McDonald's actually sued, and then Sarah Michelle Gellar was never allowed to eat at McDonald's by law.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
She was four, and she would have to apparently. And she told the story she would have to like wear a wig to like go to a friend's birthday party at McDonald's.
So Sarah Michelle Gellar, she's probably like 45 now or something.
Yeah, probably.
Do you suppose, and she's like a rich star. Like,
oh, yeah, she's doing
fine. She's got plenty of clout.
She's probably comfy. I would hope so.
I would like to think that, like, at some point in her career, like, when she realized she had enough clout, she could, like, send somebody out and get her, like, contraband Big Macs from McDonald's.
Yeah.
Just so she could taste it, taste the forbidden food.
Yeah.
McDonald's
sued Burger King, and they named 4 or 5-year-old Sarah Michelle Gellar in the lawsuit.
Wow.
Jesus Christ.
So yeah, I'm guessing Fabio probably wasn't permitted to date, or maybe just, his modeling career didn't allow for it. But yeah, he said that he wants to settle down and marry and have children. He's still handsome. He still looks like Fabio.
Sure.
Probably around 60 now, but he's still a handsome guy.
Yeah, very handsome guy.
Yeah, marry if you want to marry Fabio, he's available.
Go get him.
Go get.
Yeah, that's also a movie I want to see. Someone finds out Fabio is single, I'm like, well, shit, let's go.
Is that Fabio?
Road trip to Fabio. You've heard of the Road to Utopia? Let's go to the Road to Fabio.
Road to Fabio.
I love it.
Just get a bunch of actors together, and they all want to romance Fabio.
Again, not a bad idea. Anyway, we have time for one more, I think.
Oh, okay. Here we go.
Road to Fabio. I'm writing this down. This is gold.
This is from just the letter C.
Hi.
Hello, gentlemen. On a recent episode, Whitney was talking about a Finnish film and how the story was simple and not sophisticated. This made me wonder what makes a story simple, what classifies it as sophisticated, and more importantly, at what point does being simple or sophisticated become a detriment? Sincerely, C.
That's a simple question, but there's actually a lot of sophistication to it, because there's a lot of nuance there. You can have a simple story, but handle it in a complex way.
Yeah.
You can also have a really complicated story and handle it in a way that's extremely thuddingly obvious. To be simple is not necessarily a bad thing. To be complicated is not necessarily a good thing.
Oh, golly no.
It's just a choice you make as an artist.
A simple story, just to use some broad strokes, typically doesn't have many characters. Typically, it doesn't have too many twists and turns that make it difficult to follow.
Yeah, it has a pretty straightforward storyline, yeah.
Maybe takes place in the real world or a world that's easy to consume.
Yeah.
Not a lot of world building would be required to understand what's going on in that universe.
Like, right.
My Little Pony is a bizarre magical world, but you're already there. You know where you stand with something like My Little Pony.
I would something like, trying to think of, like, a lot of dance movies have a very simple storyline. Break Into Electric Boogaloo or Step Up to the Streets. Mm-hmm. These are relatively straightforward stories about getting better at something, finding your family and competing in competition. A lot of sports movies are relatively simple as well. But within that framework, the simplicity of a storyline can give you a lot more room for a lot more complexity in your characters, because there's not a lot of running around distracting them. They don't have to, like, oh God, we have to get to the commissioner by 6 o'clock. It's like, no, we just, we have a dance recital in 2 weeks. Well, we have 2 weeks to fill, and we can, like, interact and get to know each other better. So these things are not, like, mutually exclusive. They can actually interact very clearly, where you can have a complicated storyline but very simple characters, which is a lot of movies, actually. A lot of, like, big-budget movies Transformers movies have these weird labyrinthine plots sometimes. No interesting characters to speak of most of the time. And you can do the exact opposite. You have a very simple story with a lot of rich character stuff in it, you know? Nothing happens in Clerks except we explore the characters.
It's just conversation. Yeah. It's just a talk movie.
Yeah, like, there's some relationship stuff, but it's very straightforward. Guy's in a relationship with one woman. He kind of misses being in a relationship with this woman he dated in high school. Something bad happens. He eventually realizes what he really, really wants, but by then it might be too late. Yeah. That's all of Clerks. That's not much more to it than that.
Yeah, the idea
plot
when people get in trouble, when I start to sort of get my hackles raised as a film critic, is when a simple story starts piling on a lot of incident in the hopes that I'll be distracted from how simple the story is.
Yeah.
If you try to make me think that it's really more, a lot more, like Transformers.
Yeah, you're just cluttering it up. You're not actually adding any content.
Bad guy wants Doomsday Device. It's as simple as that. You're trying to make it sound like it's really important by throwing in all these extra characters and
all these twists.
Yeah, it turns out I need this to get this other thing.
There's this secret cult of Blabbity Blue that has been worshipping robots since the 17th century. Yeah. And it's like, that's not helping anything. And it's all you're really doing is it's just this is just a room with too many boxes in it. That's it. You don't need this many boxes in it. Yeah, you don't need this. You can clear them out, and it's just their couch and a TV and a table, and that's enough.
Yeah.
You don't need more than that.
So when I say the story is simple in that regard, that's going to be a criticism.
It can be, yes.
Because it's this gigantic thing that's trying to look like a very large experience, but it's not exploring grand ideas to match its size.
I would argue that I think simple maybe is a better, just a sort of a neutral term, but simplistic is maybe a bit more inherently critical, because we're saying that you're not, it's not because the story is simple and that was enough, it's because you took the easiest road out here and you didn't actually take advantage of what you had.
Yeah.
But again, you know, you can tell a simple story. You can tell a really complicated story. These are not inherently good or bad things.
Right.
Just how you do them. That's the old Ebert quote. It's not what a movie is about. It's how it is
about it.
Yeah.
And to fall back on this old saw that I bring up every once in a while, story is overrated. Having a simple story is usually just enough to communicate the real things that you're going to see a movie for, which is, you know, character moments, certain characters, certain moods, certain feelings and moments stand out more than the story in a lot of cases.
Sometimes even action sequences. Like, you don't actually, movies don't need a lot of action sequences.
Oh, golly,
definitely don't.
They never do. Well, they're gratuitous.
I'm sure there's an exception here or there, but, like, the vast majority of movies, you know, like, oh, there's that cool sequence in that Fast and Furious movie where all the zombie cars are chasing after him. That's not important.
No, it's
neat, but that's the only reason why it's there, is to be nifty. Like, that's just trying to, like, just add, like, a level of gold paint on something. Mm. It's not actually making it gold. And that can be fine, too.
Mm.
That's totally entertaining. It can just do it to do it. That is okay, but it doesn't mean it's fascinating. It doesn't mean it's complicated. It doesn't mean there's anything to say about the human condition. And it doesn't have to do that. But if it seems like it's trying, then it's obviously a detriment. I guess it just depends on what a movie is going for.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. If it's not trying to be simplistic, but it feels simplistic, then that would be a critique.
Yeah. Meanwhile, sometimes a very simple movie, kind of like a downbeat, quiet movie, can have the most elaborate plot that's really difficult to follow.
Oh, yeah.
I saw a David Cronenberg film today. David Cronenberg is notorious for this. He's got these weird paranoid conspiracies about all these secret organizations, and these characters belong to this one, but they're actually turncoats from this other one.
We don't need all of that, damn it.
I don't even know how much Cronenberg is thinking out, like, the world in that. I think he just has, like, sort of the paranoia in the moment.
Yeah.
That's what he's really more concerned about. Yeah. So, Videodrome has a lot of that. Naked Lunch is nothing but that. Here's your ticket to Interzone. It's like, what the hell is Interzone? You didn't think that out, did you? You just took a word from William Burroughs and threw it in the movie.
Yeah, I kind of love that, though.
Yeah.
arch and weird that is.
And, you know, in David Cronenberg's case, yeah, that arch weirdness is kind of part of the texture of the movie, but it makes the stories a little bit difficult to piece together.
Yeah.
It's like I can kind of get it from scene to scene, but overall it's like, what happened? Who were those guys? Like, you don't have it in your head when you leave the theater.
I'm with you. Yeah. Anyway, so that is it for We've Got Mail this week. Thank you, everybody who wrote in. Thank you, everybody who sent us questions. Thank you for Fabio. It's just really, really nice to hang out with you every week. So thank you so much for that. If you want to write into a future episode, feel free to do so. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, once again, what is our P.O. box?
Send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
We apologize that we can't read every single letter because we do get a lot, but we do our best. And if anything is ever super duper important or time sensitive, feel free to give us a nudge on Twitter. We're at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where we have other opportunities to interact. You can vote for future episodes. You can listen to ad-free episodes of our regular shows. We have exclusive shows about the Academy Awards and Star Trek. And we have also Hangouts every month where we're doing trivia nights now, which is really, really fun. We're going to do one, I think, later this week. Maybe next week. I have to look at our calendar, but it's soon. Yeah. Thank you everybody for joining up. Thank you everybody for keeping the show going. Really means a lot to us. Please subscribe if you haven't already. Leave us a review if you haven't already. That really, really helps the show more than I can say. Mostly we're just really, really grateful that you're here, and thank you to everybody who wrote in. That's all for now. Am I forgetting anything?
Nope, that's it.
All right. Have a good weekend. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.